We do a lot of things in our culture to distract ourselves, don't we? The fanciful, the wonderful, the things that we do, like Disney. It's a great example. It's something that we love. We're hoping to get there again someday. We've been squirreling away money. We've even got the boys involved in the process of putting money in a bank in hopes that we'll get there one day. But there are other ways in which we distract ourselves, aren't there? Playing video games. Any takers? Some, yeah. I can't play the guitar, but when I play Guitar Hero, I feel like a hero. That's what the game's meant to make you feel like. There are lots of distractions. One of my favorite songs is Brad Paisley's Online. Any of you know that song? About how you're always better online. That's why we do Facebook. That's why we do the internet. You know, he's just this good-looking stud that everyone would want to meet online. But in reality, he's a mild asthmatic. He's 5'3". He's a little overweight. And he still lives with his mom and dad. We're all better online. We like to live in a fantasy world. That's who we are. And sometimes I think that we carry that too far. Sometimes I think we even create church life that's fanciful. Church life that's removed from the reality that God is calling us to. And we might hear that in this apocalyptic passage that we just heard as Jesus spoke. He's talking about end times, but then he's talking about the times in which we live. And he's calling us to this reality that sometimes we'd rather flee. Sometimes we'd rather avoid. So let's take a look at it for just a moment and see if that bears out. Some of the disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. So they were pointing out the beauty of the temple itself. And what does Jesus say in reply? He says, "As for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be brought down." Will be thrown down, it says. And so the temple is not to last. Whatever it is that God is doing in Jesus Christ does not depend upon the temple, no matter how beautiful it is. It's not central to the equation. They say, "Well, teacher, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that they are about to take place?" And he replied, "Watch out that you are not deceived, for many will come in my name and claiming I am he. And the time is near. Do not follow them. When you hear of wars and revolutions, do not be frightened. These things must happen first. But the end will not come right away." Then he said, "Nations will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes and famines and pestilence in various places and fearful events and great signs from heaven." What we're hearing about there is the end time. And he's saying that it's going to be marked by three things: by false teachers, by war, and by natural disasters. And those things are good to know. But Jesus goes on to put things in context. We are not to be consumed by the end times, waiting upon them, trying to figure out where they are, because he says, but before all this, he has to say what's of lesser importance before he gets to the most important thing, but before all this, they will lay hands on you and persecute you. And he's placing things in context because there is a long period of time between when he comes and when he comes again. And that's the life that he's concerned about us living. We're meant to live in between the times of the coming of Christ at his birth and the coming of Christ again in great glory. And we are meant to live there. And he's trying to describe to us what that life is going to be like. He says, "They will lay hands on you and persecute you. They will deliver you to the synagogues and prisons. And you will be brought before kings and governors, and on account of my name," all this on account of my name, "this will result in you being witnesses to them." That word witnesses is very important. It's a martyrion in Greek, from which we get martyr. Now in those days, when it was spoken, when Jesus used the word, it was really about giving witness or evidence or proof, as if you were a witness in a trial. But because of the Christian faith, beginning with what Jesus did for us, It came to mean being willing to bear witness to the point of death, just as Jesus did, and many others on our behalf that we might receive the faith. From that word, we get the word martyr. He says, "But make up your mind not to worry beforehand how you will defend yourselves, For I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. And so he's saying there, people often react that way to my preaching. I just want to say, it's not uncommon, not unusual at all. I react that way sometimes in my preaching. But he's saying there, think about how differently he's asking Christians to live, disciples to live. Don't worry about how you're going to defend what it is that I'm doing. Don't worry about what your witness is going to be. Don't stew over that. Don't lose sleep over that. Don't plan for that. Don't write speeches in advance. Don't hire a lawyer to represent you. Sorry, Judson. We're hearing him say, rely upon God, for I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. You will be betrayed even by parents, brothers, relatives, and friends, and they will put some of you to death. All men will hate you because of me, but not a hair of your head will perish. By standing firm, you will gain life. So think about what we're hearing from Jesus, that there's this time coming long before the end times that's going to be an incredible challenge to us. A time in which people will hate us and revile us. A time in which our own parents or relatives or brothers or siblings, friends, will turn us out. And part of me wonders why we aren't living in those kind of times. Those are the times that are in between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ, long before the end times. So why isn't it that we don't live in that world? Now, I've raised that question many times, haven't I? I said, well, it could be that we're just totally Christian. We are ourselves, our community is, our nation is, and we're all following Jesus in such a devoted way that there's really no opposition to us being Christians. But who among us believes that to be true? I think there's a reason that we don't experience that. And it's not that we seek it out. What Jesus is saying is because of our manner of life and the allegiance that we have to Him, this is what's going to happen to us. So it's not like we're going out to pick a fight. It's not like we're going out to do battle or even win an argument. It's because of who our allegiance is to and the life we live that people will hate us. And people will even turn us over to others, and we'll have to bear witness to what Jesus is doing in our lives and why we do what we do. So why don't we live there? Why is that not our reality? And I would say to you, it's because we live in Babylon. Now, most of you probably thought we lived in Atlanta. But we really live in Babylon. Do we remember how Babylon worked in the days of the Israelites? The Babylonians were smart people, really smart people. And they overthrew, of course, Canaan, the land that was promised to the people of God. And they had all of these people. What did they do with them? They carted them back to Babylon. Why did they do that? Well, if you're going to, like the Romans in the time of Jesus, it cost a great deal of money and a lot of energy to occupy a land and subdue people. And so what the Babylonians said, you know, there's a smarter way to do this. We'll haul them all back to Babylon and they'll become Babylonians. They'll dress like Babylonians. They'll eat Babylonian food. They'll maybe one day even worship Babylonian gods. And so you, rather than subduing a people by the sword, you make them like yourself. And so they're friends. They're not enemies. They're not adversaries. They're just one of us. And right now, that's the way our culture is working. It's seeking to make us like it. It's like a master sculptor, if you will. And it's sculpting all the time, chipping away at us, the original image in which God created us, in order to make us like itself, like the culture in which we live. And why does it do that? So we'll go along. So we'll get along. So we'll buy its products, we'll participate in its commerce, we'll do everything that it does. It's advantageous for us to be like the culture around us, and the culture knows that. And often we succumb to that. We willingly become what they are trying to make us. And I think we do it in a variety of ways, or at least two ways that stand out for me. And I know these are familiar themes, so forgive me, indulge me for a minute. One of them is that they try to privatize our faith.
That is, I often quote this book that Richard John Neuhaus wrote years ago called The Naked Public Square.
And what he was saying was is that the culture was eliminating all the language of God and faith from the public square.
I mean, the classic example of that would be to remove the nativity scene from the lawn of the courthouse, right?
And so what they're saying is, oh, we don't mind if you have faith. You can be people of faith, but just keep it to yourselves. Faith is private. And in some ways, we buy into that. We go, well, that's right. There are lots of faiths. And,
we've got to live peaceably among all these people of other faiths. And so we buy into that. And what I would say to you is our faith is always personal, but never private. It's deeply personal, but it's never private. Why can't it be private? Because we believe the God who created the universe is redeeming all people in Jesus Christ. It's not a private matter. It's a public truth that the God who brought us into being is seeking to redeem us in His Son Jesus. And so it's not something that we can keep to ourselves. It's a declaration that He's made. For whosoever loves Him. Right? And so this is this public truth that has to be out there. It's deeply personal, impacts us greatly, but it's never private. And we can't buy into culture's desire for us to let it be private. We live what we live for all the world to see. The Apostle John, and the language that he uses over and over again to describe Jesus, what we would say of ourselves is that we're in the world and we're for the world, but we're not of the world. It's not private. We can't become a cult and withdraw, even though we're cultic in many ways. The way in which we live our life bumps up against the world, but we don't withdraw. We're not Jonestown. We're not Waco. We live our faith for all the world to see. It's deeply personal and never private. And we can't let the culture cause us to submit to this new image in which they want to make us. Because that's to go along and to get along. We're meant to stand out. Not in a way that is hostile, but in a way that is still threatening. Because we won't submit to other people's images. We only submit to the image of God. So one of the ways in which it tries to reshape us is to make us private. Another way in which it tries to change us and cause us to flee the reality in which we live, in which we're being rejected by the world, is to absorb us. And so we just become a part of the culture around us, and pastors just become chaplains to everything that's going on. You even see it in the way the Anglican world is organized in England. For example, a pastor is a pastor over an entire geographic area. And so he's a pastor to every person there, whether they're Muslim, Jewish, agnostic, atheist, Methodist, Anglican, Catholic, doesn't matter. He's a pastor to all those people. In some ways, there's something really nice about that, that people have somebody available to them. But the Christian witness is different than that. It's not one among many things. It can't just be absorbed into the culture at large. We're meant to stand out. In fact, what does church mean? What does the word ecclesia mean? It means to be the called out people. And so we're called out of the world, not geographically, not physically, but called out to represent something else. And it takes a lot of courage to do that in a world that says, please be conformed to the image in which we're trying to make you. Be private. Or just be absorbed so nobody notices what you're doing, the different values that you have. Phil Vischer came to a recent epiphany about that. Do y'all know who Phil is? Some of you do. He's the author, Phil Vischer. He's the creator of VeggieTales. Does that ring a bell now? And recently he figured out that all those early years of creating VeggieTales, what he was trying to do was communicate that children should be moral.
without speaking to them about the Christ who died for them and transformed them into his likeness. Are you following me? He was just saying, do the right things.
And many of us think about that when we're parents and we think Phil is great, especially in those early years, because he's confirming what we want our children to be. Well-behaved, kids that don't get in trouble, kids that follow the laws. All the laws? Maybe not. Are you following me? There's a morality out there that's the culture's, and often we just baptize our children into that morality, not helping them distinguish between what is cultural, American, if you will, and what is Christian, and what we would do if we were following in the footsteps of Jesus.
And the culture has an interest in us doing that. Phil Vischer said, you know, what we really are teaching our kids, what he realizes he was teaching his kids, us, our kids, for all those years was this combination of Protestant work ethic, of the American dream, and of gospel, little g. I don't know why he put little g gospel and he put it last, but I think because he thinks the church has actually promoted more this Protestant work ethic and American dream, and I wonder sometimes how well it can be reconciled to the gospel, the good news that God is redeeming us in Christ Jesus. The point of that is to say this, I'm probably not explaining it really well, is that Christ didn't come to make bad people good. Christ came to make dead people alive. And it's only in becoming alive that he can make us good. Are you following me? So he didn't come and say, here's the list of rules. If you follow this, all will be well. He knows we don't follow the rules and that we can't follow the rules. He's saying, I'm going to love you anyway and die for you. And that will make you want to follow the rules. You're going to see the value of being loved and transformed by grace such that you want to follow the rules. It's so important to remember that the gospel is not about making bad people good. It's about making dead people alive. And that's a different story that we're meant to tell. That's what Phil Vischer figured out. And I think it's so true. We are not meant to be absorbed in the culture and just adopt their morality. We're to profess faith and new life in this person of Jesus. That's the kind of culture that we are. That's why we exist. Not to go along and get along by becoming private, not to go along and get along by being absorbed into the culture around us. We want to be the called out people of God. In fact, we want to be a separate and distinct culture that everyone else can see. We want to live our lives in such a way that people go, wow, I want some of that. They see something different than what they're experiencing. And so it's so radically different. For example, the vast majority of Americans, if you will, live in a world where revenge is best served cold, where what goes around comes around. But how can that be reconciled to the gospel? Our culture believes in forgiveness, and that forgiveness changes people's lives. Those are radically different visions of the world, aren't they? Don't we live in that culture? Aren't we always being invited into a culture that says revenge is best served cold, what goes around comes around? Comeuppance? And yet, Jesus is teaching us to forgive. We grow up in and raise our children in a culture that says go west and to conquer. That's there from the earliest days. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Create a legacy. Amass to yourself enough wealth so you can retire and do whatever it is that you want to do. But Jesus uses the language of love and service, of sacrifice, of giving up of ourselves, of not amassing things to us, but giving them away in order to better the lives of other people. And that's the distinct culture to which he's calling us. And sometimes we go along with where the world would have us go and not where Jesus would have us go. And that's probably why people don't often see us anymore. If the church is failing in numbers or in size, it's probably because we're not living into the vision that,
that Jesus gave us. Instead, we're buying into what culture teaches us about the church. Hey, could you just be quiet? Or could you just become a part of everything we're doing so much so that you're just being quiet? Go along to get along.
That's not the original vision. If you will, indulge me for one more section.
A couple more minutes. This is a letter that was written in the middle of the 2nd century. It's called the Epistle to Diognetus. And it's about Christian life and what people observe about Christians. And think about these words. So let's say somewhere between 150 and 225 is when this is written. It's among the early writings of the church. For Christians are not distinguished from the rest of humanity by country, language, or custom. For nowhere do they live in cities of their own. We're not cults. We don't separate ourselves. We don't go out and live apart from the rest of the world. We do not live in cities of our own, nor do they speak some unusual dialect, nor do they practice an eccentric lifestyle. This teaching of theirs has not been discovered by thought and reflections of ingenious men, nor do they promote any doctrine as some do. That is, sometimes we even think that we can teach the faith by Socratic method. If we could just get people to logically hear what it is that we're teaching, that they'll buy into it. No, our faith is one walking in the footsteps of Jesus Christ. Ingenious men aren't going to help us understand what the faith is about. Jesus is. Nor do they promote any human doctrine as some do. While they live in both Greek and barbarian cities, as each one's lot was cast. So for us, it's Linwood Drive. For you, it's another street. That's the lot that you were cast. That's where you live. And it's among those people that you live the faith. But while they live in both Greek and barbarian cities, as each one's lot was cast, I thought Greek and barbarian were the same. As each one's lot was cast, and follow the local customs and dress and food and other aspects of life, at the same time, they demonstrate the remarkable and admittedly unusual character of their own citizenship. Their own citizenship. What does Paul tell us in Philippians? What are we citizens of? The kingdom. Not of America. At least not first. And so we demonstrate the character of our own citizenship. They live in their own countries, but as aliens. They participate in everything as citizens and endure everything as foreigners. This is not our homeland. Every foreign country is their fatherland, and every fatherland is foreign. They marry like everyone else and have children, but they do not expose their offspring. It's not always clear what was meant by there. In its best case, it means that they don't put them out for hire for any reason. In its worst case, it means they don't offer them for sex trade. Christians don't do that. Other people around them did. This was noted among people in the earliest days of the church. They don't participate in the culture the way everyone else does. They don't do that to their children. They share their food, but not their wives. They think fidelity is important. They live it. They are in the flesh, but they do not live according to the flesh. They live on earth, but their citizenship is in heaven. They obey the established law. Indeed, in their private lives, they transcend the law. They love everyone and are persecuted by everyone. Are you seeing what they're trying to communicate? Is that we live wherever we are, but as this distinct culture that everyone else notices. Wow, they don't expose their children. They don't put them out and offer them for hire. They don't cheat on their wives. They don't have many. They think that fidelity and faithfulness and monogamy are important. We just keep on living this life. It's not like we're trying to convince other people to do it. It's that this is what our witness is. It's the called out people of God. So all that's to say, I've gone on so long, and y'all have been so kind in indulging me,
is that we have far too long, tried to fit into the culture around us when we're precisely meant to stand out and be unusual and not adopt the customs of our people. Not adopt the customs of the community in which we live. Not adopt the laws of the state in which we live. Or even the United States in which we live. We're meant to follow the King into the kingdom and live that kind of life for all the world to see. And that takes effort. It takes a willingness to be rejected. Because in the end, that's what Jesus was trying to describe. And I'm trying to come back to full circle. He said, you will be hated by all men. You will be betrayed by your parents, by your siblings, by your friends. And it's not as if we're seeking that, but if we live this life that Jesus is calling us to and live it faithfully, that's how the world will respond. Either they'll be with us or they'll revile us because we won't conform to the ways of this world. We won't be quiet and be private, or we won't be absorbed into everything else, which is the same way of being quiet and not distinct and unusual. And so what I want us to hear in this lesson is that God is calling us to this place of incredible courage. Incredible courage in the modern day to say, I believe what I believe and I'm following Jesus, and he believes in love and service, and he believes in the power of forgiveness, and he believes that in breaking bread and drinking wine, we'll remember that a body was broken for us, that we were purchased at a price. He believes all those things, and I'm going to live that to the fullest in the world where I'm placed on Linwood Drive, beginning with my family and among my friends. And that's what it means to be the called out people of God. Do we assemble here? Yes. It's another part of our cultic characteristics that we come together and worship God in a public place. And people are out there going, why are those people over there? And they are, believe me. They're wondering, what are they doing? They might even think we're doing some weird things. And in some ways we are. We're offering praise to the living God. Incredible courage. That's what God is calling us to. That's where he needs his people to be in this day, to run the risk of being rejected, to refuse to be quiet or private, and to refuse to be absorbed, but be outwardly followers of Jesus for all the world to see. And what a witness that is. People will be blessed by it who want to be blessed. And those who profit from something else won't be, because they want to continue to make a prophet. We need to find the strength to stand out and to stand up and to be firm. And what is the last line? By standing firm, you will gain life. We'll know the richness and the fullness of what God intends for us. The more we live into that, the more we're willing to be rejected. The more we're willing to be rejected because we value love and service over profit and gain and amassing a fortune, because we value forgiveness over getting people back. That will change the world, but only when we begin to live it by faith and with courage. Amen.